week's episode of the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. I'm Chris, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And joining us again this week is a special guest. He's been with us before. Back once again, Mike.
Hello.
And we just all finished watching Stanley Kubrick's 1960 film, Spartacus.
Yes. 3.5 hour long epic.
Yeah. Well, let's cut out the overture and the intermission. We'll say an even three.
Not long enough.
No. Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
Wait. You wanted more?
Yeah. You know, I think that I don't know who said it. There's some critic out there, maybe Eva, that said that it doesn't matter how long a film is, if it's a good film, it can be 10 hours long.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as it gets shitty, then turn it off, go to the credits. But if it's great, why stop?
Yeah, fair call.
So the film was great, and I didn't give a shit about the length of it.
Mm. So I guess, like, right off the bat, initial impressions, like, had either of you guys seen this one before?
No, it's my first time.
Oh.
We had watched it as part of a year 10 or year 9 ancient civilization class.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was more to do with, we obviously just one of the big events that is glossed up, not glossed upon, but it's in there, is the beginning of the Roman Empire, for the end of the Republic, and that starts with the triumvirate with Crassus, Julius Caesar, who are both obviously in the movie, and Pompey, who's
briefly you see off in the
distance.
You see
his army.
See his army, yeah.
So, yeah.
Nice. Well, that about wraps up. No, yeah, it's a super great and super great movie. No, it's a super enjoyable film. It's a perfect example of, like, one of those old style, like, 40s and 50s, like, epic historical epics, and it's also an interesting example of Kubrick not making a Kubrick film.
Yeah, it doesn't feel... It's got, obviously, elements of Kubrick, but it doesn't... It feels like Kubrick light, maybe.
Yeah.
It's got the cinematography of Kubrick, but there's no, like, wackiness.
And never at any point did you think, oh, this is a Kubrick movie.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that could have been any... I reckon it could have interchanged any director.
There was like, one instance that I thought was very Kubrick, and it was...
Likewise, so I'm intrigued to see if we match up.
This is the scene. The sequence where there is the two armies clashing, and it's just the sound effects of marching to drums, and there's just static shots of the armies encroaching. I think it's the Roman army encroaching upon the slave army, and it's just cutting in time with the marching of just generals to army to other generals to army back and forth for, like, 4 minutes or something. Some long period of time. And that felt really Kubrickian.
Yeah, a bit like Barry Lyndon.
Exactly.
No, the moment that stood out to me, it's like one single shot. And it's when Spartacus and the other slaves arrive at Peter Ustinov's gladiatorial kind of academy, like slave training area. There's one super weird POV shot that's, like, very static and still, and it just does, like, that awkward tilt that Kubrick sometimes does, and it lands on Draba, the African slave that Spartacus ends up having to fight, who just, like, turns and stares directly into the fucking camera. And super, like, that's off-putting as shit.
He's the guy off Once Upon a Time
in
the West.
Yes, he is. Yeah. It took me fucking ages to figure it out. I'm like, where are you from?
Yeah, he's great. He's a super great actor.
Mm. But I think we might be kind of getting ahead of ourselves if we kind of already jump straight into the whole Kubrickness of it all. Probably rein it back in. Does anyone want to do the plot synopsis? We're yet to do that so far.
You can do it, Mike. You're good with history and stuff.
Well, the story obviously revolves around Spartacus, who was a Thracian slave, essentially, how long is this plot synopsis supposed to be?
If you can do it...
It's like a paragraph.
Maybe 2 to 3 sentences if you can...
Thracian slave... Working, obviously, under the control of the Roman
Republic. You can dot
board
in if you want.
Eventually, gets taken to a gladiator school, falls in love with a slave girl, and in the process leads a the slave uprising, which was actually called the Third Servile War. I think I'm pronouncing servile correctly. And then, obviously, in another subplot to it is also the machinations of the Roman Republic and the power plays between senators.
Yeah.
So,
which work really nicely as a kind of parallel to what was happening within American history at that time with elements of the Cold War and the McCarthy era. It kind of worked really well to kind of juxtapose and parallel those elements, as films sometimes do.
Well, it was written by Dalton.
Dalton Trumbo, yeah.
Yeah.
Dalton Trumbo. What's a Dalton Trumbo?
Yeah.
Dalton Trumbo was a screenwriter who was one of the Hollywood Ten, who was blacklisted and imprisoned for being a communist.
Oh.
He was actually put in prison for contempt of Congress being willing to name names of other Communist Party members, and so he spent some time in jail, and then when he got finally released, was blacklisted by Hollywood and refused to work.
Crazy.
He did work, though, under pseudonyms. He went on to, like, write Roman Holiday and win an Academy Award, but under a pseudonym and things, and this was the first... This, along with Otto Preminger's Exodus film, where, like, they both came out, like, 2 months apart from each other. They both hired Dalton Trumbo as the writer and gave him public screen credit for it, and it is credited for helping end the blacklist era in Hollywood.
Also, in part of Howard Fast, who wrote the novel for Spartacus,
yes,
was also a communist sympathiser. So,
yeah,
there are a lot of.
So is that?
It's very allegorical.
Yeah, what's going on there then? Is that
Well, it's the idea of the slave uprising
now?
Up against the system.
Proletariat overtaking.
Yeah.
The
worker, the everyman, being able to take down the corrupt political system. That's
and
it's fairly on the nose.
I mean, you can make meaning out of almost anything.
Yeah.
Though I think there were one of the most iconic scenes is the I'm Spartacus at the end.
Yes.
Where they're trying to find two.
So good.
And that people have read into that saying that was their way, Dalton and Fast's way of showing the solidarity between workers.
As well as the other thing I kind of read up on was also Crassus having the list of people who were offenders against Rome that's, you know, the famous list of people. So,
Oh, it's
kind
cool.
Of
I did
nice.
Not know that's a nice wrinkle in
Hollywood.
Yeah. And it also, because it's around the same time as the civil rights movement as well.
Yeah.
So that's another thing. Quite a portion of the movie, it's just the slaves walking across Italy, and it's quite poignant. I feel
the March on Selma and stuff like that. It's kind of interesting. Like, I think the idea of, I mean, obviously the story is telling the battle and the plight of the slaves, and in particular Spartacus leading the slave army. But, like, I found out that, like, Kirk Douglas viewed himself as a bit of a Zionist, and so he kind of viewed it as an allegory for, like, the plight of the Jews in World War II and things as well. So it's, like, all of these, like, this mishmash of, like, political and socio-political ideas kind of melding into, like, this standard Hollywood blockbuster, I guess. It's interesting.
Yeah, but it is kind of just the underdog story.
Yeah.
So you can... It's easy to apply... so many different situations on that narrative. So, copy-paste ideology.
Yes, yeah.
Your ideology goes here.
Well, it's like what Mike was saying, you could read into any, you could kind of apply any meaning, and it's, so that's why I think there are all these different people saying, like, no, it's this, and it's this, and it's this. And it's just a bunch of paint thrown on this canvas, and, well, I mean, you would just say, like, the narrative of, like, the underdog story, do you think it effectively works as that? Like, how did you find the narrative?
Yeah, it's good.
It's a good narrative. Yeah,
but it's kind of does Kubrick seems to do this a lot, because it's the same as the Barry Lyndon narrative. That's also just a guy starting from square one and building his way up to be more than a man.
Yeah.
But I don't know. What do you mean by what do you think of
Did you, like, you were referring to it as kind of an this kind of standard underdog story that you kind of often see in Hollywood epics and, like, this kind of... I mean, an easy example is it's, like, obviously reminds us all of Gladiator and those kind of...
Yeah, where was Russell Crowe?
It was the same movie, wasn't it?
Pretty much.
I don't know. I was going to bring up Gladiator because I want to know what's better. Can you compare them? Is it allowed to...
Ooh.
Yeah,
they're the same kind of film.
Yeah,
except that Spartacus wasn't a general in the first place.
No, and he was a slave that worked his way up, and it's kind of the inverse. Well, that Russell Crowe was a general who gets knocked down to a slave and has to.
Well, historically speaking, I think Spartacus is a lot more truer to the material, because there is whereas Gladiator is basically they've got that time. That period in time, and then they add.
Well, it's making fight a tiger.
And
fictitious period.
Yes. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Using elements of reality.
And I think Spartacus works way better because it is grander in scope and scale than Gladiator is, and I think that enhances this type of storytelling in particular for this period.
Is that only because Spartacus is real? Was real. Is that really...
No. I'm meaning, like they're both kind of large scope pictures, but I think what makes Spartacus stand out more is the fact that this had a cast of 10,000 people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because Gladiator is confined basically to the Colosseum and everything, so it's a smaller picture.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel Spartacus portrays a lot of that time very well. It portrays the machinations of policy in Rome, the beginnings of the Empire, rise of Julius Caesar.
Well, I mean, you have that opening voiceover that's talking about the idea that soon Christianity will come and top. It starts with planting the idea of the toppling of the Roman Empire in there. So it's all kind of
soon, as in, I mean, that was said about I think 72 BC.
Well, like what we were both saying about Gladiator being a smaller picture in terms of scope and its kind of narrative being more focused onto a single character, really, and less to do about the giant scope and scale of the world and the universe and the politics of everything going on. It's super interesting that Kubrick is making this film because he's more commonly known for making smaller films.
Mm.
Like, in terms of whenever he does kind of giant scope and scale and majesty, like 2001 or Barry Lyndon, or I mean even Eyes Wide Shut, it's very big in terms of the visuals, but it's very kind of very focused in what it's saying with its narrative. It's always driven by one single character or like one single point. So it's kind of interesting to see him kind of...
But all of those are later films. So what's he done previously to this?
Paths of Glory. How he actually got the job on this one was because he 3 years before this he'd made Paths of Glory, which is hands down the best anti-war film ever made, also in the collection, so we'll get to it eventually, and it stars Kirk Douglas, and they
such a loaded comment to make, by the way.
What?
The hands down best anti-war film ever. When we get to that, we'll talk about that.
We're going to talk about that.
Yeah, okay.
So tune in 350 episodes time. That's why I'm okay making those loaded comments, because I know I don't have to back them up for years to come.
Well, I'm making a note of that, you motherfucker.
No, it is a World War One anti-war film with Kirk Douglas, and they'd worked really well together, and that's why he brought him Kubrick in as the director. I'd also done The Killing, which is a fucking fantastic heist movie about a racetrack robbery, which is phenomenal. Like, he'd been in I think this is like his sixth film. He'd been working for a while. But then it was after this is when he... I think 2 years after this is when he made Lolita, which is the first real Kubrick film. Okay.
That's what I wanted to know. So he...
But that being said, like, both The Killing and Paths of Glory are both phenomenal films. Like, amazing, amazing films. But... And actually, Kubrick himself does consider them canon in his work.
And when did Dr. Strangelove come out?
68?
Oh, I guess that's actually...
Yeah, Lolita was 60... This was 60. Lolita's 62 or 63, and then I think Strangelove's maybe 67. 67, 68?
Okay, late 70s. That's good. Oh, yeah. 60s. Okay.
Mm.
All right, yep. Kubrick again.
That's going to be the linking thing. It's like, he's such a luminary in cinema that we can't not keep coming back to him, I think. Mm. But
Well, I feel like I'm going to fall into the trap this episode of just gushing over this film. Yeah. So I don't want to do that. But here I'm going to gush. And,
yep.
And I want to talk about the first shot of the film, which I got up and put it up on Twitter.
Yep, I'll be posting a link to it.
And it was like watching Star Wars intro. You know, in Star Wars intro, they have like Leia's ship come across, and then there's just like the overbearing Imperial ship coming through. And you don't need any conversation. You don't need anyone to tell you that there's oppression, and there's a dictator, and that dictator is oppressing some small, weak individuals. Same with this one, this opening. If you see, like, I got it up here on the screen. It was this amazing shot of just the. It's almost like the Sauron eye, just like looking over a Roman soldier, just looking over slaves the whole time in this one shot, and you get this awesome. Dolly movement, which just shows the expanse of, I think it's like a mine or whatever.
It's like a salt mine, I think.
And there is a narration going on, but you almost don't even need it.
No,
because the shot is just says so fucking much.
All the voiceover really does is tell you we're in 72 BCE and this is Spartacus. Like, that's essentially all that fucking
happens.
Well,
it also, because it talks about slavery and that it won't be. It won't end. I think
it won't end for another 2,000 years.
Yeah,
which
I think
is,
it tries to.
Which again is one of those, like, hand fisted political things, like, bringing it back in.
It tries to contemporize what's happening at the moment. So.
I think it would have been a totally fine, though, if it. Because cinema is a visual medium. It's like, no, what they're doing with this scene is they're showing without telling, and then this voiceover seems to be a little bit of a. It works fine, but it's a little bit unnecessary, I think. It's just as effective seeing what is going on, and you get the idea.
You could have had a title crawl on it as well.
Yeah, that's true. Just like, what do you mean, over the image, like totally distracting it? Or
in this,
like,
going in this
back,
galaxy.
A long time ago.
In this one.
Bears, Parkers.
Yeah. So anyway, that was a great fucking start to this film.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's right from that point as well. You're kind of hooked. Like they do a great job of with that dolly shot, like establishing this is the world that our character is living in, and then we find him and we instantly see he's a compassionate man because he's helping another slave that has fallen and is struggling with his rock hauling duties. And so it's everything is set up pretty much for what we're going to see in this opening shot. And then it just fucking flies by.
Yeah.
And
the introduction of Peter Ustinov.
Yes.
I think he canes it. Like he...
Who's that?
Peter Ustinov is...
That's the artist.
Okay.
Yes.
So the slave, the person who buys Spartacus. I just as soon as he said, he's walking with the general trying to pick out slaves who he wants to buy... And he tells his one of his slaves, who's holding the umbrella, the sun's over there, because he's holding it the wrong way. And from that point on...
He plays a smarmy dickhead so perfectly.
Every scene he's in,
but
he owns it.
It's a testament to his performance as well, how like he's such a piece of shit, but like an enjoyable one to watch. And then he somehow manages to become sympathetic at the end.
Mm.
And you actually...
I think more like you pity him is what I was doing.
Mm.
As opposed to feeling...
Sympathy. Yeah. That's true.
Well, I understood his plot, but like, I understood his struggle at the very least.
I don't necessarily agree with pity because he is also doing the good thing of taking Valerina and Spartacus's son out of the city and like helping rescue them. So it's...
Only because he's been paid $2 million.
$2 million, yeah, that's true.
So it's not actually like the virtue.
But I think that
he's a piece of shit.
But that's good. I think it would have detracted from his character if he was doing it for the good of his heart.
Yeah,
I think it's good that basically the characters stay who they are.
You know, like the thing of virtue keeps cropping up, and I thought that was one of the juiciest pieces of fruit in this film to just like munch over.
Yeah.
And the idea that you have, like, Crackus that is... I mean, there's a sequence where he's talking about the virtues of eating oysters versus snails.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, like, whatever. But it seems like, you know, and all of the politicians are the same way, too, in some regard. So moral virtue is so important, and yet, ironically, they are the ones that are championing slavery. It's constantly happening.
But they've got different... Like, Crassus wants... You could say he's virtuous because he wants Rome itself, the idea of Rome, to succeed. And then Gracchus wants, obviously, the representation of Rome to succeed. So they've all got their own, you could say, virtues in that. It's not...
You
know.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously off the base of slavery is bad, but they've got their ideas of why that should...
I think it's interesting how their ideas of what's virtuous is so, to them, to everybody, it's so grey. Like, it's so, it's not explained well,
but
based off, it's not explained why a thing is virtuous and why a thing is not virtuous.
But I think that's good, though, because, like Mike was saying, we presented all these different people's ideas of what virtue is and what their ideals are and what they want to achieve from this. And each one is even-handedly treated.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's leaving it totally up to you as an individual how you perceive these ideals and how they affect you. Like,
yeah.
I mean, obviously most audience members are going to side with Spartacus and the slave army and their revolt. But with these other characters, you can kind of... they treat it very even-handedly, where you get equal time with both political ideas and both aspirations, and it's... There is no overwhelming, like, this guy's good, this guy's bad.
Yeah.
You have both shit-talking about each other.
It feels like more of a discussion is going on.
Yeah, there's a dialogue happening within the film, as opposed to a perspective, I guess.
Yeah.
Even the Cilician Pirates, in the end, they hold to their ideals, and they go to the highest bidder, which ends up being Crassus.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and they're not seen in the film at all, but you still get that.
Yeah.
You know what they're about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone has their baseline and they stick to it. Jumping back to, like, we were obviously talking a bit about Peter Ustinov and how he fucking owns and destroys, like, every scene that he's in. This cast is fucking amazing, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, not to sound harsh, but, like, Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis, they are what they are in this film. But, like, on the other hand, you've got, like, Charles Laughton playing Gracchus and fucking Laurence Olivier. Like, holy shit. Like, and Gene Simmons as well as Ballerina.
Yeah,
like, this is like the, I realize this is like the fourth movie of hers we've seen her in the collection so far. She's fucking owning it.
Yeah.
She is spectacular in this movie.
Yeah.
So much better than Kanchi. I realize that was the last time we saw her, was in Black Narcissus as Kanchi, the slutty Mongolian lady who, like, lived up in the
monastery.
When she was in brown face.
Uh-oh. she's always doing a good job, though.
Mm.
But, I don't know, it's almost like a perfect film. I'm trying to think of anything really wrong with it, but it's not, I can't think of a single thing, really.
I would have enjoyed, I think this is me being spoiled, having seen Kubrick films and knowing Kubrick films, I would have loved for this to be what it is in terms of, like, a big historical epic, but giving Kubrick control over it and actually seeing what he does working, painting with that brush, as opposed to being a gun for hire on this piece, on this film. Like,
I suppose maybe you didn't want it. He was waiting for to make Alexander, was it?
No, Napoleon was his dream.
Dream
one, yeah. But he ended up doing kind of elements of that with Barry Lyndon,
yeah.
I guess. But, It seems, in terms of the structure and the style and the cinematography, it's all very good, but I think it's very, this is going to sound really harsh, standard, I guess? Like, there's nothing that really stands out as anything, oh my god, that's fucking amazing and has never been done before, especially in this time period. There's nothing, apart from necessarily the scope of the battle scenes. Which I still think hold up.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
Yeah.
they do, because I feel like you don't need to get crazy with camera movements.
No,
and,
no.
You know,
but
odd eccentricities for film techniques,
yeah,
and all that sort of stuff.
No,
because
no.
You can just have the camera sit there and use the
because
matte
at its core they're telling a simple story.
Yeah.
I think it's good because they don't depict any battles until the final encounter.
Yeah.
They could have shown a bit. You know, they could have shown a bit more of them taking the garrison of Rome
and
at
what
night,
was
or they could have taken
yes, the one that began with M and it's super hard to pronounce.
Metapontum.
Metapontum.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
They could have shown it.
That was actually filmed.
Oh, was it?
There were three battle scenes that were filmed and spent months making that were all cut.
Because you can't show the monster until the end.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the strategy they've used. It's
and
like
it's,
you can tease it and then at the end
I've got a bunch of this in the trivia, but it's also a good old friends at the American League of Decency.
Well, it's, yeah.
Being
like, you know, there's one shot in the of the arm getting cut off.
Yeah.
And it just turned the violence up to 11.
the
violence being,
nowhere.
You know, maybe like a 3 or a 4, like really
yeah.
mild, easy going, and then all of a sudden the fucking cunt's arm gets cut up.
What I thought was super weird was, like, you know, obviously I'm sure at the time, you know, the American League of Decency and all these people came down on the violence of the film, but, like, this is a sexy movie as well.
Yeah,
like,
you know that sequence where Gene Simmons is in the pool?
Yeah!
And they have
and
the
fern
is
yeah! What the shit?
That's really sexy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and, like, that opening scene where we're first introduced to her and she walks into his room and just disrobes and...
Yeah.
That wonderful scene where he's like, I'm not an animal. Like, ah, oh, so good.
Yeah, it's good. There's some good
voice. I mean, Kirk Douglas is trying his best. I'm not a big fan. But whenever I watch this film, I get the sense that he seems to be concentrating on the film as a whole as opposed to the individual scenes that he's in.
Yeah.
And I think that's due in part to the fact that he produced the film.
Yeah.
And it was his baby. And so he doesn't seem to be in the moment as much as people like Olivier or Charles Laughton are.
Yeah.
And
they capture their characters.
Yes.
Well, I reckon it's just, okay, that's Kirk Douglas.
Yeah. And I love the idea.
The love sequences were often quite strong.
Yes, that's where the movie really succeeds, I think, is in the small moments like that. But
between Gene and Kirk,
their
characters, there's a sequence where they're laughing hysterically because they're finally and they've met each other after escaping again. I thought that was quite strong.
Yeah.
For Kirk. Guys.
Yeah, no, I'm not
hating on this guy.
I'm not hating on him. I just think but that's the problem of casting yourself opposite Laurence Olivier. Like
yeah.
It's not you're not good and
okay.
In particular that is fault like I mean Tony Curtis, like fucking he's phenomenal in Some Like It Hot and like these other films, but when you put him up against Laurence Olivier who is doing this epic monologue and then you have him just being like, oh, geez, boss, I better, like...
Was he the
Antonidas.
Antonidas, the slave.
Who's, like, his love slave, who then goes off and joins Spartacus, and who has to battle him at the end, and is like, I love you, Spartacus! Like,
yeah, okay.
I know that they were going for something very specific, in that everyone that is a Roman is a British actor, and everyone who is a slave, with the exception of Gene Simmons, is American, and that's a very interesting and clear way to divide your cast. And
but wasn't
but the
Crassus
problem is
underling, I forget his name. He was very American, and his voice acting was
Gladius.
Yeah, actually, that's
he
true.
Was really shit.
This is the problem.
Maybe
like,
there's my
these,
problem.
The thick like Brooklyn accents that
come
through. That's what I'm saying. That was my problem with Tony Curtis.
Okay.
It was very like. Oh, jeez, like, versus, like...
It's not subtle.
Yeah,
It doesn't belong. It breaks the immersion, maybe.
And I think, that's my problem with it. And I think as well why I had a problem... I didn't have a problem, like, his Spartacus' giant speech about when they're like, we're ending this battle the way that we knew it always had to end. We're marching on Rome and blah, blah, blah. The giant speech he gives is so underplayed by Kirk Douglas, I think, that I didn't find it effective.
Well, it is cutting back and forth between Crassus' speech.
Yeah,
that's really true, actually.
That actually, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Because it was
a great
playing.
Ending decision.
Yeah.
But then maybe because as you say, you have Laurence Olivier's character being
but
played
I suppose
against Kirk Douglas. Isn't
it's harder because we've obviously seen a lot of historical epics just in general, and when you've seen this after seeing, say, the big rousing speeches of
Independence
Braveheart.
Braveheart is the one that comes to mind. You just want to praise Bill Pullman.
Yeah, I do.
It's hard, like it, yeah. Obviously, you're comparing it, but it was 40 years ahead.
Yeah, that's true.
Braveheart has an advantage because it can use Spartacus as an example.
But at least Mel Gibson's yelling so the people in the back can hear him.
Yeah,
Kirk Douglas is
they're
fucking
so
whispering
right. There
was
a point where I'm
like,
dude, half the crowd that kind of needs to
hear
shit.
I wanted that Monty Python, The Life of Brian cutaway. It's like,
what did he say?
I think he said, blessed are they. Like, I was waiting for that.
Yeah, good point.
No, but good job, Kirk. I feel I came down harsh on that.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Maybe we got a meet in between and say he did an alright job.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's just, I ended up finding myself way more interested in what was happening on the Roman side of the film.
Yeah. But it's such a fascinating time in that period between the rise of Augustus and the end of the Roman Republic, because it basically another 500 years of the empire.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to, I think they capture the power plays of these of Gracchus and Crassus well, even though, and now this is going on historically.
No, yeah,
rant,
I know where you're going with this.
Gracchus wasn't in the Senate at the time. There were brothers called Gracchus, but they were about 50 years ahead. But I think they capture.
It was an encapsulation,
you'd
say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just a power play, because Crassus did use the Servile War to his advantage, and it also helped with Julius Caesar's rise. So, yeah, I think the chess game
analogy kind of situation
is
always an interesting thing to watch on film.
Yeah,
in epic settings,
And yeah, when there's historical basis, I think it gives it a bit more grandeur as well, and it helps that. Because otherwise,
So are the matte paintings.
Yeah.
They're great.
Yeah.
Well, matte paintings.
I mean, we've talked a bit about the... Like, I mean, this is just something I'm intrigued by. The idea of, like, historical epics, and, like, we've talked about Gladiator and Braveheart and all these kind of more modern versions of that. Do you think this one, viewing this now, nearly 60 years after it was made, does it hold up?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if I was a teacher in... and I had students for Roman history, this would be the first movie I'd show them.
If you didn't want to work for a term.
We knew quite a few, so long
to watch.
You start
the kids
just the way it captures a lot of society at that time very well.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of other like historical movies suffer from inaccuracies, and which you have to do, because otherwise the story should outweigh.
If
the,
you paint with too broad of a brush, you're gonna fuck it up.
I mean, you look at we talk about Braveheart. I mean, the Braveheart battles were nothing like what they were depicted. On camera. Ditto, you could say the same. For example, 300 as well. The actual battles themselves were probably quite boring, more gruesome, but boring aesthetically.
Yeah.
So. But this one, I think, showed was something people talked about earlier about the battle formation, a very cool, very Kubrick shot. I think captured Roman formation and Roman battle plans very well.
Yeah,
And it took me back to Total War.
Yeah, fair.
Nice,
well.
Man.
No, the I mean, Tom's just put the image that I'll post up on Twitter up on the screen for us, and It without a doubt, I think, still stands up as one of the best battle scenes in cinematic history. I think it is so fucking phenomenal. The fact that it is, I think it lends. It's mainly because it's real.
Yeah.
And you actually.
Oh man.
The editing that you were talking about earlier and how it's all kind of paced out to this kind of drumming sound and everything, and it's just fucking scary and haunting and hypnotic to watch at the same time. It's fucking phenomenal.
Just because that you get that first wave and like, oh, that's quite a large army, and then that second wave comes over as well, and then
The moving into formation, you actually get a sense of how many and what they're actually facing, and
and then while they're battling, you get the other army coming off from the side.
Yeah, and you're just like, yep, you're boned.
I know this.
Game over, man.
But I was thinking that this film you're talking about, whether it's holding up at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you know when you watch older films, there's always that gap in stylistic choices of filming and like just technical ways of putting together a sequence that are just too far. The gap between then and now is just too far, and it just seems dated.
Yeah.
I never had a situation in watching this film where.
Yeah.
I thought that it's now just the technicalities were pissing me off a bit.
Yeah.
The story is always, and the characters are so strong anyway, that even if that did occur, maybe you wouldn't even notice.
Yeah.
But I think the strongest point was the fact that you don't have things like CG for an army sequence, for a fighting sequence, makes it kind of, I'm going to say, potentially better than, say, a Lord of the Rings battle. Mike, I'm not going to. It can be grander in certain respects.
Yeah.
Because there is, you know, thousands of real people.
Yeah.
On the landscape pretending to fight.
Yeah.
As opposed to CG people that you know when you're watching that, you go like, fuck man, there's like three guys that worked really hard at that, but looks good. But then to watch this, you go like, wow, 1,000 people put their minds together and bodies together to make that.
Yeah.
And I think like on that similar note, like what you were saying about the cinematic styles and things, I think that also helps to maintain your interest in your things. It helps me.
Do you want a thesaurus?
Yeah. let me gather my thought and say that again. Like on a similar note, like what you were saying about not having to rely on advanced cinematic techniques and things to kind of keep you maintain your interest. Even in the smaller moments of the film, by getting a good director and a good script and good actors together, you can let it play out in the wide. Like the best example is like the snails and oysters scenes, or the scene in the bathhouse with the chess game analogies and things. It's all played out in a wide shot. There's no need to cut to coverage because what they're talking about is, and how they're saying it, is so fucking strong and interesting that it perfectly maintains your interest.
Mm.
They don't need to be flashy with it, I guess, and they just let it.
This might be just the genius of Kubrick, though, because.
But I think you also have to learn some to Dalton Trumbo with his script as well.
I don't think you should wax too much lyrical for Kubrick, because
especially with this
because
one.
Because what we were saying earlier was he in the end was just a gun for hire. So
yeah,
I think a lot of it has to do with
the casting.
I think everything everything is strong enough. So.
It's like
a jigsaw puzzle. Like
that.
All these pieces fell perfectly into place to create this fucking fantastic epic.
Yeah. I'm not saying that. Yeah, let's all hail Kubrick.
No.
I'm just saying
but
that
we should.
The guy, you know, the guy is able to have the foresight to make decisions that are not going to allow his art to become, you know, just like the previous generations of films.
Yeah.
For previous generations of film goers.
Yeah.
But how was it received? Do we know how it was received when it initially came out?
Yeah. Do you want, like, I mean, that could be a perfect stepping stone into trivia, I guess.
I don't know, like.
I'll just say, like, yeah, no, it was very well received.
It was.
It still to this day has a 96% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay.
It's, yeah, it was very well received. Like, it wasn't.
Even though it was a piece of commie propaganda?
Well, I mean, you know, yeah, I'll get into that a little. I've got some of that in the trivia. But No, it didn't. It wasn't necessarily as well received as like Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
Or those kind of other really fucking epic films of this time, but it was still very well received. And it, you know, it, I think,
would you,
I think it was the highest grossing film until 1970 when The Towering Inferno came out.
Okay.
So it made a shitload of money for
Universal. Okay. We just talked about Ben-Hur. That's the other big epic piece of the time. Which would you...
This?
Yeah.
I
haven't seen Ben-Hur.
in
the collection?
No. I
Philistine.
Yeah, I know.
As much as I was ragging on... Not really even ragging. As much as I was paying out, fucking hating on Kirk Douglas, it seemed like earlier,
yeah.
I fucking hate Charlton Heston. Like, it's so brutal. Like, yes, the chariot sequence is great, and it's but like, fuck, man. I don't think Ben-Hur holds up very well at all.
Yeah.
It's fine, but I would much rather, if I was given the option, I would rather watch Spartacus.
Yeah.
Because I think it has the stronger performances and a more interesting story.
Alright, what else can we talk about? Is it the same cinematographer that Kubrick usually uses?
No.
Because doesn't he have a regular?
Not really. He kind of fluctuated a bit.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've got some of this stuff in the trivia. Yeah, it's... Kubrick was very much a gun buy. He had no real say in any of this, and... Yeah, he and the cinematographer did not get along.
Oh, cool. Well, that's interesting for Trivial Matters later.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we jump on
just
the...
Oh, just there was a shot.
Yeah, no.
No, the, yeah.
That.
The fight scene. Spartacus' motivation, I suppose.
Oh, I see.
Because he lost that battle.
He
lost the fight.
For those listening, again, I'll post the image up on Twitter. It's the, we're talking about, Tom's got an image up on screen of the first... battle.
The duel
between Spartacus and Draba, played by Woody Strode.
Who were forced to fight in front of Crassus for the amusement of his hoes.
Yes.
Whatever.
For his hoes.
They were fucking hoes.
They were horrible.
They were just mean bitches.
Yeah.
Well, but I saved this image in particular because there's this shot which you put up on Twitter, which I thought encapsulated the relationship between the upper class political leaders versus just the slaves so well, where you just have two dudes fighting to the death and it's just so fucking brutal. And then they're in the background, and then Crassus's right hand man is just nonchalantly turns to him and is just like, "How'd you get me fucking to be general of your army, man?"
So anyway, about other bullshit.
Can we caress our egos for a minute while these people kill each other?
We don't even care
about
that.
We don't give a fuck
about
that. And I was just like, fuck, that is so brutal, but
yeah.
It's just just such a wonderful way to illustrate how much of pricks these guys are.
Yeah.
Mm.
Great sequence.
And it's kind of interesting as well. Like, I think, Mike, you might have been going on to say this, like, the idea of setting up and establishing, like, Spartacus's mentality, I guess, with it. Like,
yeah.
When he's shown mercy by Draba, and it's
yeah.
like, no, I'm not going to give these people the satisfaction of us killing each other.
Yeah, but it's because Draba says, when he first meets Spartacus, I'm not your friend. I don't know my name. You're not going to know my name because I'm not your friend.
Yeah.
Because when I have to kill you, and then in the end he... switches.
Yeah,
he's the first. I don't know. It's like the first instance where someone says no, and then that sets off that chain reaction where all the other Spartacus does, and then everybody else does.
Yeah,
so they just say no eventually. So yeah, it's a lot of shit going on in that sequence.
Yeah.
This whole film is hinged on Draba.
Yeah, he's the keystone.
Yeah, and cracking it and throwing a fucking broken trident at people.
That was so rad. Like,
yeah.
What a way to go.
Yeah. Went down in a blaze of glory.
Yep.
With a knife in the back.
And it's quite brutal after as well, when you see them all going back to their cells and he's hanging upside down.
Yeah.
Just in the mess hall.
Just like, yeah, this is what happens. Don't you fuck with us. So
Well, they fucked with them, and then, whoops.
honestly, when the revolt happened, I was just thinking like, well, that's what you get when you slave, when you train slaves to be murderers and give them a bunch of weapons. What were you expecting?
Well, they were pretty shitty garrison.
Yeah, oh yeah. That part where three of them climbed up the fence and the fence went whoop and fell down.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone noticed it, but there was one actor playing a Roman soldier, and I don't think he was expecting the gate to fall because he got smushed.
Yeah. I noticed in that scene some people got fucked up. Like when there was a shot of people like pushing Romans off the out of the atrium and into the stadium area, the little fight area, and there was one dude who like tried to catch a curtain and swung and fucking hit his face on like the stonework and then collapsed and he crawls off screen. Yeah. he's crawling, I need time out. He's like trying to escape the scene, and I was just like, oh, that happened. That guy fucked himself up.
In the end battle sequence as well with the rolling pins of fire.
Yeah, the guy was like, I can jump this, and just owned himself. Fabulous though. Yeah.
There was heaps of guys jumping that shit.
Yeah. Apparently this film, when it was being shot, they like bragged in like Hollywood Reporter and Variety and stuff, like they employed all 157 registered stuntmen working in Hollywood. Every single stunt person worked on this film.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's pretty special.
So how did they do the arm cutting thing?
Oh, strangely, that was a prosthetic attached to an amputee. The same amputee went on to play the infamous one-armed man in The Fugitive.
Really?
Yeah. Trivia bomb that isn't actually included in my trivia. So, yeah. The guy who framed Harrison Ford for killing his wife is so Prevasic Pharmaceuticals could pass their new drug law. I watched The Fugitive like a week ago, so I'm like way dialed into that movie.
Go on.
So Harrison Ford plays this surgeon who... you should see The Fugitive, guys. Tommy Lee Jones deserved to be DiCaprio for that Oscar. So good. He doesn't care.
He doesn't care.
If you guys don't have anything else, we can jump into trivia, or was there any...
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, let's go.
I'm sure there'll be some stuff in here that'll spark it. So the film won 4 Academy Awards. Best Supporting Actor for Peter Ustinov. Best Cinematography, Best Art Direction, and Best Costume. And it was also nominated but didn't win Best Editing and Best Music. It was also nominated for 6 Golden Globes. Best Actor for Laurence Olivier. Best Supporting Actor for both Peter Ustinov and Woody Strode, who played Draba. He got a fucking nod. Wow. Yeah. Best Score and Best Director for Kubrick. And it went on to win Best Picture.
Man, the score was excellent.
Spider-Man's
theme. There's like the love scene that's kind of got portions of just his regular theme too. It felt...
You'd expect a score like this to be very bombastic, but it's very kind of nice and subtle. It's
calculated.
Yeah.
It's like a John Williams score, I felt like.
Mm. And it was also nominated for Best Film at the 1961 BAFTAs. So it was very well received when it came out. So Kirk Douglas wanted to play the titular hero Ben-Hur, but the film's director William Wyler wanted Charlton Heston to play the role. Douglas was then offered the antagonist role of Messala, which was eventually given to Stephen Boyd, but because he refused to play second banana to Charlton Heston.
Fucking...
Okay. In later years, Douglas admitted that he had made this film, Spartacus, as to show up William Wyler and his company.
Spite.
Yeah.
What a weak little bitch.
Yeah. He once said that was what spurred me to do it in a childish way. The I'll show them sort of thing.
What a dork.
Yeah. In order to get so many big stars to play supporting roles in the film, Kirk Douglas showed each a different script in which their character was further emphasized.
Wow. The egos on that set.
Yeah. Yep.
That's disastrous.
The fucking spectacular David Lean was considered to direct, but he was offered and declined. Then Laurence Olivier was asked to direct, but he relinquished the directing assignment as he felt a dual role of both actor and director would prove too demanding. I think, I mean, obviously he did write and direct and star in his own shit, like, but there were passion projects like Hamlet and things like, and, you know, Henry V, so that's some shit he was more in tune with.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. So, Kirk Douglas had an unhappy time for most of the production. After a major falling out with the original director, Anthony Mann, he asked Stanley Kubrick to direct, with whom he had collaborated 3 years earlier on Paths of Glory. However, he had an equally difficult time working with Kubrick. After the production, Douglas claimed that he would not collaborate with Kubrick again if he was given the opportunity.
Kubrick's pretty hard to work with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that fucking super sad story about, like, how he made Scatman Crothers just break down crying during The Shining.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know what you want. He still, to this day, holds the record for most takes, single takes on a film, and longest continual shooting of a film.
Well, so, what are they?
Our longest takes were with Scatman Crothers in The Shining, and it was something like 600 takes.
Oh.
And longest continual shooting schedule was Eyes Wide Shut at 400 and something days continuous.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. In his autobiography, Kirk Douglas admitted that he replaced Anthony Mann because he felt he was too docile, especially with the powerful actors and dominating the cast. He added that he seemed scared of the scope of the picture. So that's kind of why he nixed him. Cinematographer Russell Meddy walked off set, complaining that Stanley Kubrick was not letting him do his job. Meddy was used to directors allowing him to call his own shots with little oversight, while Kubrick was a professional photographer who he himself had shot some of his previous films. Subsequently, Kubrick did the majority of the cinematography work. Meddy complained about this until the release of the film, and even at one point asked to have his name removed from the credits. However, because of his name in the credits, he won the Academy Award for Best Cinematography.
He's like that those guys that you have in group projects that you see it the first day and then not until the very end when you're actually
and
presenting
it. Goes through and yeah. I really wish I looked. If it's not online, I'll try and find it, and if I can, I'll post it to Twitter. I really, really, really want to see this dude's Oscar acceptance speech and see if he was just like, thanks. I put a lot of work in. See how he claimed the glory. So Kubrick was not given control of the script, which he felt was stupidly moralizing, in his own words, that's what he called it. After Spartacus, Kubrick always kept full control over every single aspect of his films. Kubrick also wanted to shoot the picture in Rome with cheap extras and resources, but Edward Moule, the president of Universal Studios, wanted to make an example of the film and prove that a successful epic could be made in Hollywood itself and stem the flow of runaway producers heading for Europe.
That's interesting.
That's really... Because it captured... Rome and Italy very well.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have said... I was under the impression that they had gone...
It was all shot over there,
Or,
I would never think that... I would never think that they would have done it in Hollywood.
Mm. The intimate scenes were filmed in Hollywood, but Kubrick insisted that all the battle scenes be filmed on a vast plane outside Madrid. So they're actually for those big battle scenes.
Okay.
They were shot in Spain.
Okay.
The
thing is, if you do a few establishing shots... And then you go back to Hollywood.
Yes.
Then it totally works.
Yeah, the battle scenes were shot in Madrid, but everything else was... Yeah. So, for the battle scenes, 8,000 trained soldiers from the Spanish infantry were used to double as the Roman army. So, when you said 1,000 earlier, it was 8,000.
Fucking oath.
Kubrick directed these armies from the top of a specifically constructed tower. However, he eventually had to cut all but one of the gory battle scenes due to the negative audience reactions at previous screenings. So precise was Kubrick that he even arranged the bodies of the slaughtered slaves that he had each corpse assigned a number with specific direction and instruction.
Cool. Fuck, man, he's so...
Insane.
He has such... Yeah, he has a vision and he needs that vision done.
Yep.
Is there... That footage is lost, isn't it?
Some of it's shown up. Some of it has been reappropriated back into the longer cut that we watched. And it is still available. I think a few odd deleted scenes have surfaced, but
and that's on the in the collection.
Yeah, for some of the restoration stuff. But for a lot of it, the original negative was really badly damaged. So actually, to do the restoration in 1991, and then again in 2015, they had to go back to a color corrected black and white negative and kind of pull from that because they couldn't use Kubrick's copy of the film because he donated that to MoMA, I think. and it was considered an archival piece of film, so they couldn't actually use it. And
does that mean you're not allowed to touch it?
Yeah, and the Universal copy had become like stained yellow over time and kind of deteriorated. So, yeah. So I think a lot of the stuff is gone, as is.
That seems weird to me because if it's say the last copy,
yeah,
wouldn't you at the very least want to just digitize it? Give it a shot.
But if
you're not going to touch it, you're never going to see it again.
Yeah, but it's that fear of going and running it through the projector or the thing again, and you'll absolutely fucking destroy it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So, yeah, but
it's worth that risk.
It is worth that risk.
Yeah.
Because the alternative is it sits in a box, and no one gets to see it.
Yeah. So, Kubrick wanted to shoot at a slow pace of 2 camera setups a day.
What a torture of my
fucking opinion. Insane. but the studio insisted that he do 32.
Mm-hmm.
A compromise of 8 was met.
It skewed one way. It skewed a particular way.
When Kirk Douglas asked Stanley Kubrick his opinion of the I Am Spartacus scene, Kubrick, in front of the entire cast and crew, called it a stupid idea. Douglas promptly chewed him out in front of everyone.
I thought it was very touching.
I know, like, I included that because that just made me laugh when I was researching that, because I just thought, like, that's just Kubrick being a dick.
Yeah, being a cynical asshole.
Being a cynical asshole and also establishing superiority over his actor. Like, it's just him, like, a subtle director trick of just, like, the scene that he's like, if you as an actor come and be like, this is great, isn't it? And he's just gonna be like, I'm giving you nothing. Just, like, fuck your ego. Like, it's pretty great. When Stanley Kubrick removed the close-up of Spartacus' crucifixion during the finale, Kirk Douglas, by his own account, grew so angry that he actually attacked Kubrick with a folding chair.
Sweet.
Yeah. Filming was plagued by conflicting visions of both Kubrick and Trumbo. Kubrick complained that the character of Spartacus had no faults or quirks, and that he actually then later has distanced himself from the film, so much so that he disowns it now.
Wow, that's so drastic.
Yeah.
It's not that bad.
It all boiled down to the fact that
it's a personal thing for everybody.
Well, that's
involved.
But that's the thing, like, with Kubrick and all the films he made, he controlled every single aspect of that film, those films. Like, they were very personal to him, and they were his expressions of art. And the fact that he wasn't allowed to do that with this pissed him off, I think, so.
But then why would you agree to do the movie?
Yeah, why would you agree to be a hired hand?
That's
a hired director.
I guess it was his first experience, and this is kind of what led Kubrick to kind of leave Hollywood and live overseas in London and never really come back. Like, he kind of had this...
It's the last...
He'd made little independent films before, and this was his first foray into a big studio production, and really his last, to be honest.
Mm.
Until he teamed up with Warner Brothers, who would let him do whatever the fuck he wanted. So, it's a great success.
Yeah.
During the arduously long shoot, Tony Curtis allegedly asked Gene Simmons, who do I have to fuck to get off this film? So yeah, apparently everyone was not having a great time making this movie. Ingrid Bergman, Jean Moreau, and Elsa Martinelli all rejected the role of Verenia. Kirk Douglas actually wanted a German actress to play the role, as that's how she was actually originally portrayed in the book. Sabine Bethman was then cast, but when Stanley Kubrick arrived, he fired her and offered the part to Gene Simmons, who was initially rejected because of the whole British actors only playing Romans
thing. Ingrid Bergman?
Yes, from
Autumn Sonata. Autumn
Sonata,
okay.
And Casablanca.
Yeah,
okay. Apparently, Laurence Olivier and Charles Laughton, much like their characters, were longtime rivals and barely on speaking terms while making this film.
Well, I think that their dynamic on screen is...
It worked, right?
It worked. I think that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, hire two people that fucking hate each other to play characters that fucking hate each other.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That would work well.
Yeah.
apparently, Charles Laughton's prima donna behavior aggravated everyone on set, where he would storm off and even threaten to sue Kirk Douglas because he trimmed his part down. What a bitch.
Yeah, but I suppose if he's given a script that emphasizes his role and then you
yeah.
come in and it's like, where's this, this, and this?
Yeah.
Fit in you.
So Hedda Hopper and John Wayne, both leaders of the Hollywood powerful right wing element, publicly condemned the film as Marxist propaganda before its release.
It's so crazy. This film has so much going on outside of the film.
Yeah. They would set up picket lines and things, like saying that this is communist propaganda and blah, blah, blah. And what also helped was when President-elect John F. Kennedy crossed picket lines to go see the movie. He's like, fuck you, it's a movie.
Yeah.
Fuck you, John Wayne, you piece of shit.
Sweet.
I mean, The Searchers is cool, but fuck you. So the slave's final battle was originally supposed to be intercut with Verenia giving birth to her child to give a contrast of destruction and creation.
That threw me a little bit, because the scene before, when they're in the tent together, she's
fine. Yeah.
And then got a baby on the battlefield.
Yeah.
So
that would have been really interesting, but yeah, apparently it was cut because of running time. Like,
what's another 5 minutes?
I know, right?
At that stage.
This is like, that. When I read that, I was like, I can kind of see why Kubrick got pissed off at them, like, for not having control. Because that's like a very interesting fucking idea that would have, I think, emphasized this battle.
It's pretty important, right?
Yeah.
Because it gives meaning to Spartacus's death.
Yes.
In the end of the film. The fact that his legacy is living on through the story of him being told to his kid.
Yeah, versus, and like having it, him being born in like this giant momentous occasion in Spartacus' life, like the final battle and things, like it would have.
In a way, he won through the fact that his kid is alive and free.
Yes,
but
yes.
You don't see that kid being born.
No, you get to see it as a tiny baby, and at least he gets to see the kid. At least that's one thing.
Yeah. Almost too long.
Not long enough.
Yeah, that's it.
The sound of the crowd cheering Spartacus kind of chanting over and over again, was actually recorded at the 1959 football game over at Spartan Stadium in Michigan State, where Michigan State beat Notre Dame 19-0.
And do they chant Spartacus?
Well, they got them to come in and, like, the sound crew came in and recorded and, like, said, okay, can we get you all to chant this?
Okay.
And so it was a sold-out stadium at a football game chanting that.
Yeah.
And the final bit of trivia, it's kind of an interesting one, and it has to do with a scene that was originally cut out of the film and then put back in for the restorations later on. The original version included a scene where Crassus and Antoninus, fucking super weird to pronounce that name.
Antoninus,
thank you. I always kept forgetting how to pronounce it. There was that scene where he attempts to seduce in the pool, and the conversation between, do you eat oysters or snails? Like, that subtlety.
So he was trying to. He was trying to.
Yeah, yeah, and he was establishing, like, there's moral ambiguities with sexuality.
Yes.
Like, that's that whole thing.
But then there was no closure.
Because he ran away, because he's like, I don't want to suck this old man's dick.
Oh, yeah, of course. So oysters are vaginas and snails are cocks.
Yeah.
Right.
Because they go back in their little homes.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, of course.
And oysters because they smell
funny. I thought they were just talking about food.
So in the end, the scene was cut, but it was put back in for the 1991 restoration. However, the soundtrack for the scene had been lost in the meantime, and the dialogue had to be redubbed. Oh. Curtis was able to redo all of his lines. He was 66 years old at the time. But Laurence Olivier had died. Joan Plowrythe, his widow, remembered that Anthony Hopkins had done a dead-on impersonation of Olivia, and she mentioned this to the restoration team. They approached Hopkins, who agreed to do the voice of Olivier and of Olivier's lines in this scene. Hopkins
awesome.
Is thanked in the credits of the restoration.
That's
he
awesome.
Was a kind of protege of Olivier's and studied with the Olivier Theatre Company and things, and actually knew him and was a friend, and that's why his widow was like, oh shit, Tony does a good Larry impersonation.
Cool. That is super cool.
So yeah, I didn't pick it up while watching the movie, but I kind of want to go back and watch that one scene and be like, that's fucking Hannibal Lecter right there.
Not done.
Yes.
So, pictures maybe.
Yeah, that is all for trivia. A lot of it, unfortunately. But we'll move on to the actual...
Unfortunately, it was pretty good trivia.
We'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. The film is still available as a 2-disc DVD through Criterion, but it's one that I don't think we'll see a kind of Blu-ray restoration or anything of, and it's not available on iTunes or Hulu through Criterion because they're kind of, you know, they have their version and they can't do it again kind of thing. Like, the distribution rights have kind of being relinquished a little bit. Yeah. But the Criterion Edition does come with an audio commentary by actor and producer Kirk Douglas and actor Peter Ustinov, novelist Howard Fast, producer Edward Lewis, and restoration expert Robert A. Harris, and title designer Saul Bass. It also comes with a scene-by-scene analysis by Dalton Trumbo, additional Alex North score compositions, rare deleted scenes, vintage newsreel footage, 1960 promotional interview with Gene Simmons and Peter Ustinov, 1992 interview with Peter Ustinov, behind-the-scene gladiatorial school footage, the 1960 documentary The Hollywood 10, plus archival documents about The Blacklist, as well as original storyboards by Saul Bass, hundreds of production stills, lobby cards, posters, print ads, as well as the original theatrical trailer and booklet that Criterion always do.
It's fucking heaps.
A lot in that two-disc edition.
Have you watched any of it?
I watched the documentary about The Blacklist, The Hollywood 10, because I am super interested about that and had kind of recently seen the Trumbo movie starring Bryan Cranston, so
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was intrigued by that, and it's super interesting little watch.
All right.
Mm. But I guess if you guys don't have anything else, that'll probably wrap us up for this week's episode looking at Kubrick's, or probably not really Kubrick since he disowned it, 1960 film Spartacus. if you have any comments or queries, please hit us up on Twitter at Criterion Quest, where we'll also be posting Tom's artwork for this week, as well as a few kind of stills that we've talked about. Or send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com. Or head on over to the Criterion subreddit over on Reddit, and you'll also see Tom's artwork, which I'll be posting there. Other than that, we will be back next week when we look at Bernard Trevanier's Coupe de Tachon.
What?
A French crime comedy.
Right, that sounds cool.
Yeah, it's supposed to be really fun, so.
Ah, sweet.
But I guess,
sweaty.
Yeah.
It's really hot here.
It's hot today. We're recording this on a 40 degree day in Melbourne, so we're going to wrap this up and turn the aircon back on. For this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom.
And I'm Mike.
Thanks for joining us, Mike.
No worries. Anytime. Except for next week.
Yeah. That's it. You're interested by Coupe de Tachon?
No, I'm waiting for The Rock.
Yeah, will be back. So that's in 3 weeks' time. You'll hear Mike again when we look at another epic historical blockbuster. But yeah, for this week's episode, thanks guys.
See ya.
That's it.